listening to The Star Spot, episode 84 for Sunday, August 23rd, 2015.
I'm Justin Trottier, and I'll be your host at The Star Spot. The Star Spot is a space-themed podcast that focuses on all aspects of astronomy and space exploration. Episodes feature interviews with guests of wide-ranging backgrounds: scientists, engineers, educators, artists, politicians, and business people. Topics are similarly broad, from the latest space mission to how the universe began, from why humans explore to how we can make exploration economical. We'll also include a segment called Current in Space, bringing you reports on news and developments that may interest the space enthusiast. You can now find the show on Facebook at facebook.com/thestarspot or follow us on Twitter at @thestarspot. He is the first Canadian to travel into space. But with momentous changes rocketing the space programs of many nations, how many more firsts will there be? Today I'm joined at the Star Spot by a real hero of science and exploration, Dr. Marc Garneau, to discuss the past, present, and future of human spaceflight. But first, here's what's current in space.
How realistic is farming in space? As it turns out, it's already been done. Of course, we aren't talking about large-scale agricultural industries coating the surface of the moon or Martian landscape, but something rather more modest, that is, growing lettuce in space. Back in May 2014, NASA's Expedition 39 crew set out to harvest a small crop of lettuce. And they were successful. It took 33 days to grow the lettuce, which was returned to Earth 5 months later for scientific analysis at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. But it seemed like an end of one. Could it be repeated? And, more importantly, could it be sustainable? Just last week, in the International Space Station, NASA's Expedition 44 crew members, including the American Scott Kelly and Kamiya Yu from the Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency, successfully grew another batch of lettuce, red romaine lettuce to be exact, and they ate it. That's right. For the first time, astronauts have chowed down on produce made in space. And apparently, according to reports from the two men, it tasted great. The lettuce was harvested from what NASA calls the Veggie Plant Growth System, designed by a private corporation called Orbital Technologies, or Orbitech. Much like growing lettuce here on Earth, the team first planted the seeds, watered them, and provided light. Except in this scenario, the seeds came in special pillows that were dormant for 15 months, the water was rationed carefully, and the light was used as a special red-blue-green LED panel for optimal growth. After about 1 month, the crop was ready for the picking. However, the crew didn't eat all of it. After all, they set some aside for scientific analysis, where nutritional content will be determined. This required freezing the samples to preserve them until they can get back to Earth many months later. So what's next for NASA's Veggie Plant Growth Initiative? How about other vegetables or fruit? Spinach, okra, carrots, cucumber, plums maybe? Well, it's very possible. If a space crew can grow sustainable produce that lasts over weeks or months, it really is a game changer. Periodic food resupply missions, which are very expensive, would no longer be necessary. And rather than freeze-dried vacuum-packed foods, astronauts could enjoy fresh food. That's a morale booster. And NASA is already thinking of possibilities with long-term travel, say to Mars, and this recent development is a tremendous step forward.
Stars are perhaps the most common objects in space. With their diverse classifications in size, temperature, and luminosity, they literally make up the universe. There's one at the center of each solar system, with potentially hundreds of billions of solar systems in each galaxy. It's also not a stretch to compare stars to living organisms. They have lifespans. They are born, shine, grow old, and die. And our own sun is no exception. And to understand just what the ultimate fate of our mighty star will be, we simply need to study an object like ESO 3781. Located roughly 3,250 light-years from Earth in the constellation of Hydra, ESO 3781 is an example of a planetary nebula, an astronomical phenomenon caused by the ejection and expansion of gas from its central dying star. Of course, planetary nebulae have nothing to do with actual planets, as the term was coined by astronomer William Herschel, who merely believed they resembled planets through a telescope. The European Southern Observatory's Very Large Telescope in northern Chile has obtained the best view yet of ESO 3781, appearing like a ghostly, cosmic soap bubble suspended in the blackness of space. While beautiful to behold, not all stars can form planetary nebulae, only those with a mass less than about 8 times that of the Sun. Any heavier stars will die as violent and spectacular supernovae. The way in which these lower mass stars end their lives is not as dramatic as a supernova, however. As one of them grows old, the hydrogen fuel in its core will begin depleting, thus causing it to expand into an enormous red giant. Continuing to burn through its fuel, it will eventually collapse, losing its outer layers of gas to the fierce stellar winds generated by the swollen star. After the outer layers disappear, what remains is the seething stellar core, which begins emitting ultraviolet radiation, ionizing the surrounding gas. This subsequently causes the ever-expanding shell of gas to glow in bright colors, creating a planetary nebula. In the case of ESO 3781, its gas shell is around 4 light-years in diameter. Although they may be grand, planetary nebulae are also a fairly short-lived feature, lasting only a few tens of thousands of years before dissipating into space. It's not the end stage in the star's demise, though. Following the dispersion of the gas shell, the leftover stellar remnant will burn for another 1 billion years before consuming all its remaining fuel, becoming a small, yet hot and incredibly dense lump of electron-degenerate matter known as a white dwarf, which will slowly cool over billions more years, eventually darkening into invisibility. The Sun will go through this exact process in approximately 5 billion years. While the death of the star which gave life to us may seem melancholic at first, it's also quite a glorious and necessary occurrence. Planetary nebulae play an indomitable role in the evolution of the universe by spreading heavy elements like nitrogen and carbon, originally formed within their central stars, back into the interstellar medium, where those elements can create new stars, new worlds, new life, and new civilizations to thrive, as ours has. But one prodding question arises from this. Will there be anything left of humanity to witness and appreciate the ghost of the Sun?
While we've all been watching Pluto over the last while, some scientists are hard at work unraveling other mysteries of our outer solar system. A new study from the Leiden Observatory and Cornell University proposes that Sedna, a dwarf planet and an object with one of the wildest known orbits in the solar system, was actually captured from another star. Sedna had been a mystery since its discovery in 2003. It is extremely red, has a diameter of about 1,000 kilometers, and when it was found, it was about 90 astronomical units, or AU, from the Sun. A very impressive distance indeed, since our outermost planet, Neptune, is 30 AU from the Sun. As it happens, we were lucky to spot Sedna at all, and its detection was possible only because it is currently near its perihelion, its closest approach to the Sun. Its furthest point, the aphelion, is 937 AU. This gives it an extremely oddly eccentric orbit with a period of 11,400 years. This orbit is so strange compared to everything else in the solar system that its formation was immediately in question. It is too far out to have been put there through Neptune's influence. So, if it formed in the solar system at all, it must have been moved outwards by an unknown planet beyond the Kuiper Belt, or perhaps a passing star. This one object, therefore, must be an important clue to the grand events that occurred at the birth of our solar system. The new research, led by Dr. Lucy Jilkova, performed thousands of computer simulations to narrow down how Sedna could have been captured. In this scenario, the dwarf planet was formed around another star, a star born in the same original nebula as our Sun. The newborn Sun must have had many such nest mates, as most nebulae that produce stars will produce 1,000 or so at a time. When they are born, they form what's called an open cluster of new stars, and they disperse from there. We have found some stars that may have been born with ours, but over the past 4.5 billion years, they must have dispersed quite widely. Back in the days of the original open cluster, however, they could have passed very close to one another. The computer simulations showed that Sedna could have been captured from a star passing around 340 AU away. That's more than 11 times Neptune's distance, but well within our own Oort cloud. The neighboring star itself was perhaps 1.8 times the mass of the Sun, and with a mass like that, the star would have lived for only 2.3 billion years. Sedna certainly traded up, as its birth star would have died more than 2 billion years ago, and all that had been left of it now is a white dwarf. Along with Sedna, a whole population of Sednitoes would have been captured, and these might be found by future observations. In fact, the paper predicts that there should be almost 1,000 of these Sednitoes in similar orbits, and that the close encounter by the two stars also allowed our Oort cloud to pick up several hundred other large objects. If the model is correct, we now know what to look for. Perhaps with the European Space Agency's Gaia telescope, which is doing its initial observing now, and should find that Sedna was formed. Its strange characteristics give us a window into the past and an opportunity to figure out the events that shaped our outer solar system and the history of all the planets, including our own.
And that's what's current in space. Marc Garneau was selected as one of the original six Canadian astronauts in 1983, following a career as an engineer in the Canadian Navy. Dr. Garneau traveled into space on three expeditions aboard the space shuttle. He then served as president of the Canadian Space Agency from 2001 to 2005. He has been a member of Canada's federal parliament, representing the riding of Westmount-Ville-Marie since 2008. Dr. Garneau was appointed to the Order of Canada in 1984 and then promoted to Companion of the Order of Canada in 2003. He is the ninth chancellor of Carleton University. I'm very excited to be joined here at the Star Spot by Dr. Marc Garneau. Thanks for joining me.
Nice to be with you, Justin.
Dr. Garneau, you are famous across Canada for many reasons, but in particular for being our nation's first astronaut. So let me just jump right in there. What prompted you to apply to be part of that first group of astronauts back in the early 1980s?
Well, actually, I was sitting at home that day. I was in the Navy. I was an engineer in the Navy, and I saw this ad in the newspaper. This was in 1983, and the ad literally said, Canadian Astronaut Program. Of course, we didn't have astronauts back then. And I read the ad, and it said that Canada was looking to create a corps of astronauts, and this was in response, basically, to the fact that Canada had developed the robotic arm, the Canada arm on the space shuttle, and NASA wanted to thank us by offering a couple of Canadians the opportunity to fly in space. And that's what led to this ad. And when I saw that ad, I said, my goodness, that would be a fantastic adventure. I regarded it as an adventure. And I said, I absolutely have to send in my name for that.
So no hesitation, you just jumped right into it.
I was sort of a bit shocked to see it because I really didn't think Canada would have a space program. I mean, we had a space program, a very good space program, but we didn't have an astronaut program, and I didn't think we would have one because obviously we didn't have a space shuttle or a rocket to send Canadians into space. So, I mean, the first thing I did was to speak to my wife. We talked about it a little bit, and she said, go ahead, give it a go. And so I didn't hesitate to send in my application. I didn't think I was going to get chosen, but I thought, if I don't, I'll never know.
Now, you were chosen. Not only that, but you became the astronaut with the shortest training of any astronaut to that point in time. Did you envision it would happen that quickly? That must have made you even more nervous than you already were.
Well, it certainly did happen in record time because from the moment that I was chosen, which was around about the 1st of March 1984, until I flew on the 5th of October 1984, We're talking about 7 months. And now, of course, I was not expected to be a fully trained astronaut capable of understanding all of the systems on board the space shuttle. But nevertheless, I did have some serious training to do, because if you're on board, you have to know some of the procedures. You obviously have to know how to use the communication systems, you know, have to know how to prepare food, you have to know what to do in an emergency, all of those things. And of course, you have to get to know the crew. Plus, you need to learn the work that you're going to do. In my case, it was 5 Canadian experiments that I would be responsible for. So it was a pretty crazy schedule, but we somehow made it work.
Between you, and you were up 3 times, and between your first and second shuttle experience was, of course, that horrible 1986 Challenger shuttle disaster. And I'm wondering, preparing for that second experience as compared to the first, what difference in terms of preparations, in terms of the mood that hung over the astronauts in preparation for that second shuttle experience, how did those differ from first to second?
Well, there's no question that the Challenger disaster in 1986, and I flew on Challenger in 84,
right,
had a profound effect, because when I first flew, as I say, in October of 84, I was on the, it turned out to be the 13th flight of a space shuttle, so it was early days. Nothing had gone wrong, or at least nothing had been detected, and all of the flights had come back safely. And so there was this sense before I flew that well, there had been at least 12 missions, and that shuttle seemed to be a safe vehicle. And so, of course, we were all totally shocked and of course very saddened when on the 25th, it was I think the 25th flight of the space shuttle Challenger in January of 86, that this horrible tragedy occurred 73 seconds after launch. So from then on, although I did 2 other flights in 96 and 2000, the picture, because it was played back over and over and again,
right,
the picture of what could happen was very real in your mind. It was not enough to make me say, well, I'm going to give up being an astronaut, but it certainly was present on your mind and made you realize in a concrete manner that going into space is still something that carries a certain amount of risk.
While you were up in space, did anything ever happen that made you seriously worry you wouldn't be able to accomplish your mission?
Not on the first 2 missions. On the 3rd mission, which was my last mission in 2000, this was mission STS-97, we were bringing up the first solar panels for the International Space Station, and we had 2 spacewalks planned. We were adding a large piece to the station. It was called Truss number P6, P for port, 6, and it contained the boxes that had the large solar panels that were going to be deployed during our mission. And I was the arm operator, so I took all of this, there's about 35,000 pounds of payload out of the payload bay and brought it within a few inches of the International Space Station, and my colleagues, Joe Tanner and Carlos Noriega, were out there doing a spacewalk, and they bolted it to the station. And then came the rather dramatic moment of us deploying the solar panels, and they came out sort of accordion fashion out of these boxes, and they're very, very large solar panels. And what happened was that part of the alignment devices that allowed the solar panels to extend jumped out of their sprockets, out of their alignment devices, and this created a problem. We did deploy them, but we wouldn't have been able to retract them, which is something you have to do. So they had to schedule an extra spacewalk. So there was a little bit of drama from that point of view. I'm glad to say that the people in Mission Control came up with a new plan to do this additional spacewalk so that we could go up and fix the problem that had been created. It turned out that the solar panels, which were all folded up, as I say, like an accordion, were sticking on the way out because they'd been in storage for a long time, and this caused the misalignment to occur. but in typical NASA fashion, with a lot of good work on the ground and a good third spacewalk, we were able to solve the problem and to achieve complete mission success.
Dr. Garneau, would you say that being in space was transformative for you as a person in terms of your perspectives on space and time and our place in the cosmos?
Absolutely, it was, and particularly from the point of view that of how I looked at Earth after that.
Right.
Certainly when you are orbiting and you're only taking 90 minutes to go around the planet and you've been around it hundreds of times, you take every opportunity you can to look out, and you realize and you start thinking about the fact that this is the cradle of humanity. This is where 7 billion plus people live, about 200 countries, and it's surrounded by the blackness of space, and certainly for the time being, there is nowhere else to go. You begin to think about what we share. You know, we share the atmosphere, for example. It doesn't sort of belong to any particular country or stay over that country. It circulates, and we have a collective responsibility to take care of that atmosphere, for example, greenhouse gases or the pollutants we put up there. And the same applies to the oceans. And so you think about these things that are collective responsibilities as opposed to individual national responsibilities. You think about the fact that down on this planet, which is beautiful to look at, that we are damaging it. 7 billion people, whether intentionally or not, can put quite a stress on the planet. And you think about the fact that there are always a fairly large number of conflicts going on where we're fighting each other.
Sure.
And when you look at the planet and you realize that there's nowhere else for us to go, you begin to think a lot about surely we can find a better way to get along and to take care of the planet. And I think that's a fairly common sense that most astronauts get from having this unique perspective of looking down.
You've been all over the country and, of course, beyond, sharing this perspective as a politician and as an astronaut. How would you gauge the overall feelings of, let's say, the Canadian population with respect to the space program?
I think the vast majority of Canadians are very proud of what people like Chris Hadfield have done. Obviously, when Chris was up there for 6 months and he was constantly telling us about space in such an entertaining and educational way, and I think that it made Canadians very proud to know that a Canadian astronaut was actually, for half the time he was up there, for the 3 months up there, he was commanding the station. I think that brought a great deal of pride to Canadians. Now, most Canadians don't really know much about the non-human side of the Canadian space program, the fact that we have been pioneers in communication satellites, that we have communication satellites that are controlled by Telesat and that link us all together across the country, that we have been pioneers in Earth observation with our radar-based observations, and Canada is the world leader in that area. And those are very useful things that are done with satellites in space. And we've done a lot of interesting space science with spacecraft in space. In fact, Canada got into space at the very beginning. We were the third country in space with the Alouette satellite back in 1962, and that was for scientific reasons. Canadians are not as aware of that, but you know, I tried to take every opportunity to tell Canadians the rich history of Canada in space. Naturally, they will tend to focus more on the human side because, you know, people and are naturally drawn towards other people. But I think when I tell them about it, they're very, very proud of what Canada has done in space and hopefully will continue.
I wanted to talk to you just briefly about your transition to political life, which has kept you in the public domain, of course. And I'm wondering how much your motives what part of your motives were the desire for a stronger space policy to make that part of our public policy debate?
Well, I have to say it very much so, because I was president of the Canadian Space Agency when I was invited to run politically, and I one of the thoughts in my mind is, why would I want to become a politician? And one of the reasons was because I feel very strongly about Canada's space program. It's a very distinguished program. It's a very useful one for Canadians. We've built a space industry. We have great space scientists across our universities in this country. And maybe I can promote that, to be honest with you. That was one of the strong motivators for me when I was asked to go in, because there aren't very many people with science or engineering backgrounds sitting in the House of Commons, and general sense, I thought I could help from that point of view.
Have you been frustrated at times trying to push a more robust space policy or just science policy in general? Without commenting on specific governments, but just in terms of the compromises of being in politics and the bureaucracy and all of that, have you found it more difficult, more frustrating than you imagined it would be?
Well, I'm in the situation that I have not been on the government benches. I've been in opposition.
Right.
So, in effect, that's the difference between being in government and not being in government. When you are the government, you do actually make decisions about how much or how little you're going to fund different programs, including the space program. But that's where the decisions are made. From what I can do from the opposition side is to promote the importance of space, because it has an effect on the lives of Canadians. It is a viable industry. It's a multi-billion-dollar industry in this country. And so I try as much as possible from the opposition side to promote the Canadian space program, because it has been a positive force for Canada, and I will continue to do that. Hopefully I'll have a chance to do that on the government benches at some point during my political career.
Speaking of the future, and just in our last few minutes, I did want to turn to the future. I've heard you say on a few occasions that Canada needs space. How seriously do you think Canada needs space in the future? We've put up, you know, telecommunication satellites. We've done a great job connecting the vastness of our land. Do you continue to see priorities for Canada in the future with respect to space?
Yes, and I see it even more, and I'm particularly focused on Earth observation, because we're doing things to our planet, and I think everybody is aware of the fact that that global warming is occurring. People are certainly aware of the fact that we are contaminating through pollution both our air and our oceans. This is having an effect. It's having an effect on climate on climate in individual parts of the world. The climates are changing, and that of course has an effect on things like agriculture. The amount of pollutants have an effect on the sort of acid rains that fall down and affect not only agriculture but also our forests and of course the quality of the air, and that has an effect on people's ability to breathe, particularly if you're elderly. So lots of things are happening down on the surface, and looking down, obviously we have to monitor this from the ground level, but space offers us the potential of really looking at it from a macroscopic point of view, and I think in that respect it's extremely useful. And of course we will continue to want to communicate with each other more and more as more technology is developed, so communication satellites will continue to be important. We've been pioneers, for example, in using Ka band, which is very, very high frequency, but provides an ability through satellites to achieve broadband levels of communication. And of course, everybody uses a GPS. Well, those are possible only because of satellites up in space. We don't have those, but Americans and Europeans have them. And of course, we watch the weather every night, and that comes from satellites that are in space that provide the weather. So there's a very useful function provided by space, and I can only see that increasing as we develop more technologies and as our planet is more under stress.
In terms of human spaceflight, more specifically, with the U.S., the space shuttle being retired, with the rise of this private space industry, do you see those as having profound effects in Canada, in where our own domestic space program is headed?
Well, Canada has been very good at partnering with other countries, because we don't have a big enough program to do anything Right. Or that's not true that we're always alone, or that we can't do anything by ourselves. We have done things by ourselves, but very often if you get into bigger programs, particularly the human spaceflight programs, it makes sense for Canada to be a partner. As we were a partner on the shuttle with the robotic arm, we're a part owner of the International Space Station. We have cooperated with many countries and put payloads on their spacecraft, and it's worked out very well for Canada. I hope that that will continue. I hope that there will be future human space endeavors and that Canada will play a role, because we've developed unique expertises, and if we play a role, it is something that we can afford, and yet, at the same time, it gives us an enormous amount of visibility. And I think it's exciting for Canada to be part of the effort to go out there into space, to advance our knowledge of the universe, to advance our capabilities of extending our human presence beyond the surface of our planet.
I know you're a super busy guy, so I'm just going to ask you one last question, if I may. Dr. Garneau, you are Canada's first astronaut, first person in space. Can you envision a first Canadian on Mars? When do you think that might happen?
That would be, of course, a wonderful dream to imagine, and I've been sort of watching over the years. There was a time when we seemed to be almost ready to go with a bunch of other countries and to make that effort to go to Mars. If you had an Apollo kind of effort, you could put humans on Mars, in my opinion, certainly within the next 20 years. But it is a big venture. It is a complex one. It's an expensive one, and it requires a lot of countries to have the collective will to do it. I would love to see it in my lifetime, and I imagine an international crew, and I would love nothing more than to see a Canadian. That will depend on whether we're a partner in this big and vast and complex program, but we certainly have the capability to do it, and we'll just have to see if all of that comes together in the years to come.
Dr. Mark Garneau, it was a real thrill to chat with you. Thank you so much for joining us here at the Star Spot.
My pleasure, Justin. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you for joining us at the Star Spot. Mind and universe continually expanding.
The Star Spot with Justin Trottier is an astronomy and space-themed podcast based out of Toronto, Canada. Please send comments or questions to starspotpodcast@gmail.com. The Star Spot is produced by Ying Zhang Li, marketing and promotions by Natalie Morcos, guest hosting by Denise Fong, news production by Benjamin Jenkins, news contributions from Julia Mazurchuk, Mallory Warren, Jessica Campbell, and Victoria Duncan. Web design by Blair Renault, graphics by Carmina Svillens. And I'm your host, Justin Trottier. Thank you for listening.